it feels good to be back, everybody. Welcome to the Fundamentalists Podcast. My name is Elliot Morgan, and I do internet and stand-up comedy, and I'm here with my podcasting partner, Peter Rollins, who is a philosopher and a speaker and a writer. Just released. Have you released Making Love? Is it officially out for the
masses? Not officially out yet, but we're releasing the trailer today.
Cool.
Yeah.
Today as in October 24th.
Yes, October 24th. And I think we're going to release it officially on Christmas Day for people who are bored after all the family stuff.
Bored and horny after all the
family
stuff. Great.
They can watch this. This making love.
This pornographic adult film.
Exactly.
I've seen it, and I think it's unbelievably good, man.
Oh, thank you.
It's so good.
I'm so excited. And it's going to be pay what you want. So maybe I shouldn't do it on Christmas Day because everyone's broke.
Yeah.
Just give me 1 cent. But it's pay what you want, but you also get a commentary on the movie.
Well, you said it yourself.
Well.
Pay what it's worth. I mean,
yeah, pay what it's worth. Well, then you'll get, yeah.
You're good to go. No, it's really, I went to some friends the other night, and we had all watched it together, and then privately behind your back we also discussed it.
Ooh.
And so that way you didn't get the sort of like placating, like, hey, that's a really good film, but it was all the same. It was all very, very supportive and good.
Thank you.
Everyone was like, yeah, holy crap. And so it what's cool about it, just for those listening to this this tangent, it's got a feel to it that's like not too, this is going to sound like whatever, because it's called Making Love and it's a short film, and you can tell it's kind of got this like noir feel to it. But what's cool about it is it doesn't seem put upon or pretentious. There's a suspense element to it. It's like there's an actiony kind of like feel to the whole thing that keeps it moving and keeps it interesting. And it's not like how I think a lot of, at least for me, a lot of short films and stuff come off kind of like, okay, like a little gratuitous. This is like, the pacing is good, the acting is great, the writing is fantastic. So I'm super excited for it.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Anytime. Yeah. Anyway, this is a podcast where we talk about different things with life, different things that are going on through the lens of solely evolutionary psychology, which is Pete's go-to. It's psychoanalysis and philosophy and all this fun stuff. If you would like to support the podcast in any way, you can go to Wink or trywink.com/fundamentalists. That's TRYWINC. It's like WINK, but it's WINC, and it's a wine company, and you can take a quiz that'll tell you what kind of like wines they think you'll like if you're new to the world, and then they ship you wines, and it makes you feel really fancy.
You take the alcoholic. That's your one criteria.
Yeah, I take excess as my favorite flavor. I'm not drinking right now.
You're not. Actually, you haven't been drinking for a few weeks.
For a few weeks is what I like to say, but it's been about a week and a half. Yeah, but it's been a nice change of pace. I was doing it too much.
Okay,
we can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit later, but I might drink tonight because I have to. I'm going out to dinner.
Oh, that's lovely.
With a lady.
Oh, very nice.
Mm-hmm. Whose bed I am very good about making.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Very good. I'm glad to hear it.
That's related to our live podcast, if you guys get a chance to listen to that. The Fundamentalists.
Yeah, you know what I love about this? I love that we've been going long enough now that we can make inside jokes about previous episodes.
Yeah.
You've made about two or three, and I'm like, oh, wow, we've got to that point. We've done like 30-odd episodes, and so we can kind of make these little winks to people who actually listen to them all.
Yeah, we're just looking at our numbers, and we're like, it's so funny, because I'll go and I'll do like a show somewhere or some travel thing, and without fail, somebody is like, I love the Fundamentalists, but we were just looking at our numbers and we were like, oh, we got to get our numbers up.
Yeah, so we're gonna have to be more serious about this. Yeah.
We kind of, I think, got a little comfortable, and we've kind of been like, we're gonna record when we record, and then I'm busy, and then you're doing your thing, and then it's just like, I'm not home.
Yeah.
And then when I come home, it's like, we're hanging out or something, and every now and then we'll be talking, and we'll be like, you want to do one? And we're like, no, we'll do it later. So we're going to get better.
And, you know, I got a kick up the ass last week, because I hung out with the Minimalist guys, and we did a podcast. One of my favorite conversations I've done on a podcast.
Yeah.
Really, really fun. But they have an incredible setup.
Really?
You know, they do it so well, you know, and it made me go, right, you know, they take it very seriously. How they do everything is thought through. And I'm like, oh yeah, we get out of bed, meet in the middle room, and just whatever. And there's something really nice about that. But it did go, right, oh, you know, I think these guys are really doing it well. They're producing great product. I had a great time with them. And I was like, okay, let's. Although we did talk about that 2 weeks ago, and we haven't done anything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. we get really into the podcast when we're doing the podcast. And then when it's done, we're like, yeah, we'll get to it. I think it's like that. I fall into that like get motivated world where it's like, that kind of thing. Because when you watch the Minimalists podcast, they're so, it's so welcoming. Like when you watch the video, the stuff that you showed me was just, it's so easy on the eyes. It's soft lighting. It's welcoming to the viewer. And it's a quality that, like, effort wise is probably, you know, not that much more. It's just like they put in that little extra effort and they end up with something that you go into and you're like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And it takes just a little bit that we're not, we're gonna get there. But
like maybe stands for the microphones, things like that,
some crazy
something crazy
or a place that we actually record that's not our our living room. Let me make sure we're actually recording. We are actually
recording. Wouldn't that be our ironic? Professionalism. Is this thing actually on?
Like I can't see the button clearly saying we're recording too. Just so shows how little I know this machine. Anyway, so yeah, trywink.com/thefundamentalists. You can get $25 off, and it helps support the podcast and helps us pay for this to be edited and posted. And then sometimes we use that money to, I don't know, I think it pretty much all goes back into the podcast.
It goes into editing, we've got Corey's our editor, great guy. He kind of puts this all online.
You're a sweet boy. Sweet person. This particular episode is about money. It's about the Mega Millions. Last night, Pete picked me up a ticket, and I'm glad you did. I Venmo'd you $2.
Did you? Yeah, well, I'm glad you did, because I was slightly nervous, right, that if you didn't and I won with the ticket.
That's why I did it.
Yeah, exactly. There's no paper trail. I would just disappear. To be honest, I'd probably just disappear anyway.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think
you would. But I would give you the $2 back.
I think you like the idea that you would. You'd give me the $2 back, Hey, man, fair's fair. Here's your $2 back. No, I think you would, like when we both pause and take drinks of coffee at the same time. So there's just pure dead silence on the podcast. So yeah, we did, you did this party. You went to this party. I went on stage last night and I had a great show, great time.
Yeah, it went really well.
Yeah, it was so nice. Shocking.
Really went down well. And it was recorded.
It was recorded.
Great.
Yeah. So it's lightning in a bottle. And then I'll watch it back and be like, oh, okay, well, I'm imagining these. But anyway, I started talking about, I opened up on a friend of mine, whose name I won't mention, Joe Beretta, and he did this podcast or this tweet about how if he had won, it was a tweet about like, oh, I imagined winning $1 billion and what I would do with it. And he was like, I imagined all of my friends and all the houses I would buy for them. And I was like, that's so sweet. I was like, that's the sweetest thing. And then I was like, the only thing I'm going to give to my friends if I win $1 billion is a goodbye. I am leaving. And
a handshake.
And a handshake at best. And the reason for that is I actually love my friends and I know that money corrupts people. And I'm not going to let that happen to my friends. And I'm going to be the sacrificial lamb and I'm going to keep all the money and I'm going to buy an island and I'm going to just go on the island and I'm going to invite whoever, celebrities, you know, basically I'm going to be a beta Dan Bilzerian. Do you know who that is?
No.
I hate that I even mentioned his name because I don't want people to look him up, but he's like the most stereotypical alpha male in existence. He's like multimillionaire who literally walks. Dude, you got to look up his Instagram. He's like, he's flocked with like, or flanked with like, you know, sort of bombastically attractive women just like in bikinis, and it's excessive and it's just pure like, here's him with snakes and guns and like he's you know working out and he's like always
lots of phallic symbols everywhere.
and it's really, but anyway, that's my like fantasy. And you think that's, you say the same thing, you're like, if I win I'm out of here, which I don't believe that. I think what would happen. Here's what I really think would happen. Okay.
I said if I win, I'll make my friends do terrible things for money. That's where my mind went, which I don't know why, what that says about me.
So it's really fun, though. I started doing that last night on stage. I was like, here's a fun angle. I was like, here's how I'll buy you a house if I win $1 billion. I'll absolutely buy you a house. I'll actually build you a house, whatever dream house you want, wherever you want. But there's a 50% chance that I'm going to put cameras everywhere in that house and you'll never know. And if you start looking for it, I'll know. And so then you lose the house. And I'm going to put cameras and I'm going to put speakers in the house. A 50% chance. Maybe it'll be a totally normal house. Maybe you won't be being watched the entire time, but there's a 50% chance that everything you do will be watched.
Can I pay extra to make sure that everything I do is watched?
That's that great line in Making Love that I think it's in the trailer. Do you ever get that uneasy feeling?
No one's watching.
No one's watching you. That's really good.
So it's a 50% chance that you're being surveyed.
That I'm surveying you, yeah. And then the goal would be like 5 years down the road when the friendship has naturally dissipated and gone through the natural life cycle of a friendship in no particular dramatic manner, you're still in your house that you
now,
have.
Mind you, the friendship might be strained by the fact that I know that there's a 50% chance you're recording everything I do.
But let's say you've convinced yourself. Yeah, you're just like,
it's fine.
Those cameras must be so small. Otherwise, they're every, like, I've, you know, I put the Christmas decorations up. I've had kids. Who cares at this point? Blah, blah, blah. And then what's going to happen is about 5 years down the road, you got a 4-year-old running around. You got a wife, different world. You don't pay rent. It's kind of a weird story. You have this old friend who won the lotto. He disappeared. Now you have this house. Out of nowhere, I want my voice to come over the speaker while you're making a sandwich. And it's just like, honey mustard with turkey. Okay. All right. Something like that. Yeah. Something that's just watching the mundane thing that you're doing. And then out of that, you will be jarred from the, your monotonous middle class life in which I've ensnared you.
Wow. Well, why would you give me a 50% chance of knowing this? Because that takes away from the impact a little bit.
What do you mean? So just don't. Oh, so just.
So don't tell me at all.
Just build a house.
I mean, there are certain ethical issues with this, but, you know, those aside.
Well, I like the idea of getting involved with getting somebody a house. This. And them knowing there's a risk and knowing what risk, it's sort of like the, like you were saying, if I won't say all the scenarios you were pitching, but they were insane. But one of them that I really liked was when I was saying no to your hypothetical offers, you were like, okay, we'll just get, you know, let's get Mike to come, Mike, buddy, Mike. He's like, let's get Mike to come around and I'll give Mike $500,000 to take a bat and smash the car windows. And I was like, of course I would do that. There's no way I wouldn't do that. But you deflected onto Mike. And then I was like, oh, we'll get Mike to do that. But the, it's very, anyway. it's about whether or not you would do it. And that kind of like sick, you know, demented thing. Anyway.
Well, see, I think those Japanese game shows are kind of maybe designed by some crazy millionaire. Because that's another way you could, you know, give your friends like houses and stuff. But they have to go through some sort of Japanese game show.
Yeah.
Horror that you invent.
Yeah, you know? I like that a lot. Yeah, some kind of weird obstacle course that's like just absolutely batshit crazy. Yeah. That'd be really fun. Anyway.
There you go.
So we're talking about the lotto. Pete, talk to us about the lotto a little bit. Talk to us about the idea of winning big.
Well, this is a good example. So I, as you mentioned, got invited to a lotto party. First time I've played, so I didn't even really know what I was doing, but went in and took a lucky dip. Mm-hmm. I think I just asked for lucky dip. Because I had to turn up at the party with a lottery ticket, and I did the Irish goodbye terribly. So Daniel, I'm sorry I left, but you were in the middle of talking to lots of people. But had a great party. We were there, and it did get me thinking about the lotto. And
what do you think the odds are that Daniel listens to this podcast?
I think that's 0%. Yes. So a couple of things. First of all, when I started philosophy, you know, what they try and do is they make philosophy fun. So one of the early mind experiments in my class when I did analytic philosophy, they said, is playing the lottery rational? And as you would guess, they kind of push towards it not being rational. Mm-hmm. And the reason is they go, okay, what are your percentages chance of winning? And it's incredibly small.
It's like 1 in 322 million or something.
Is that right? Yeah, like not big, not big odds. And then secondly, they rate how each dollar is valued because not every dollar is valued the same. So for example, the first $1,000 is very valuable. So you would give that a utility value of say 10. But then the next 10,000 isn't as valuable because, you know, you've got the 1,000, so maybe you put a utility value of 5 on that.
What? I don't understand anything you're saying right now.
Well, so right, if I gave you $1,000, that would be pretty significant. You go, well, that's pretty useful. But if I gave you $1,200, the extra $200 doesn't do very much. So if you basically value every dollar with a certain utility, and it's basically like it's the first million is worth a lot more to you than the second million, you know what I mean. And then the 10 million will, you know, that means a lot, but 20 million, that is not going to double your pleasure, right? So every dollar of the lottery gets a utility value.
If you gave me 30 grand right now, that would be... Yeah, I see what you're saying. That would be about as helpful as 60 grand.
Yes, that's kind of it. So for this billion, for example, and say maybe it pans out at 500 million or whatever. You know, after 250 million, the next 250 million is just not going to be as valuable, as useful.
First of all, it was $1.6 billion.
Wow.
And the amount that you would net, I think they said, was something like 900 something million dollars.
Yeah.
That's insane. And it is unfathomable.
That's unfathomable. It's a huge amount of money. But what they would do is they would do all of these mathematical equations, and then they'd go, right, you know, it's probably not reasonable to play the lottery, but we do. But the thing I always thought was, hold on a second, you're not actually bringing into the equation the reason why people really play, which is you're more playing so that you can have the fantasy. So what we did is by paying $2, we had an hour-long conversation about all the ridiculous things we do with the money. So in one sense, people are paying for the fantasy of what they would do with the money. So when I was at the party, all of the fun was in the first hour before the numbers were called.
Yeah.
And people were talking about what they would do. Some people were serious, some people were joking. But as soon
as... We should mention we're all dead serious in this podcast, by the way. Everything we mentioned about putting cameras in friends' homes...
Yes, that is serious.
...commit crimes. Yes, that is... We were not joking.
If anyone wants to fund us for some of these experiments, we are
again,
more than happy.
Trywink.com/fundamentalists helps us out.
So as soon as the numbers were called, it was like such a, you know, anticlimax.
Yeah.
Everyone was like, oh...
But what are the odds that we got 30 people in this room and not one of them
won
$1 billion?
But we got what we paid for, which was, you know, 2 hours of fantasy.
Yeah.
So in one sense, it's like holidays. You're not just paying for the holiday. You're also paying for the fantasy of how good the holiday will be. So you pay your $1,000 or whatever, and then you've got 6 months of thinking about how good it's going to be. And then it might be all right.
Yeah.
But you're not just paying for the holiday. You're paying for the creation of a fantasy. And this interests me because I think this is how society works, is that largely the issue is we maybe are working to get a certain amount of money. We're in a job that we don't necessarily like. We're doing all of this stuff. But we have a fantasy that if we work hard enough, we'll get to a certain goal.
Yeah.
And it's actually the fantasy that keeps us doing the activity. And the big question for me is when are our fantasies actually causing us to damage ourselves? So it's different me paying $2 once for the lotto, but maybe someone's paying $20 a week and they don't have a lot of money. And so the fantasy of winning is actually causing them or encouraging them to keep buying these tickets. And therefore, what they need to do, in the words of psychoanalysis, they have to traverse the fantasy, which is to kind of realize that the fantasy, while it gives you a certain pleasure, might be damaging your concrete life.
Yeah.
And also realizing that if you got the fantasy, it wouldn't necessarily change your life in a way that fundamentally made you happier and feel better as a person.
Yeah, man, it reminds me, the first thing that reminded me of is Christmas. We're coming up on Christmas.
Yeah.
And I remember like one of the major realizations of my life was when I realized that Christmas itself is like just fine. Like it's cool and I love it. But the day of Christmas Day is like, especially when you get older, and like for me, my brother doesn't have a kid, I don't have a kid, so there's not like a baby around, and it's like there's the immediate family, we're all adults and we're all joking around, and it's great, and it's a beautiful thing. What Christmas is the season and the like leading up to Christmas. And I remember that, even realizing that when I was like 10 years old, and being like, oh, there's something about Christmas Day that has like a very sad thing to it when you're a kid, especially when it's Christmas morning and it's like the traditional sort of, you open up all your presents, and that kind of has a lot of feel too to it, where it's like you know, you give a list and then magically this wondrous wizard leaves you everything you asked for one day out of the year. It's like, that's an insanely euphoric thing for a kid. But then when you realize that it's like about the anticipation and like, oh, it's December 3rd and 4th and you're counting down the days and all that's like where the beautiful thing is. And I think that's sort of like ingrained in you as a child, or at least it was ingrained in me as a child. And then when you buy the $2 ticket, it's like, well, this is just like $2 so that I have a right now to talk about, because it's not even fun to talk about it if you don't buy the ticket.
Yeah.
It is interesting too, because it's like, it's $2, you're not gonna win. And it's so funny that like as small as those odds are, they're your only chance of being able to really actively and like freely engage in the fantasy.
Yes.
Even though it's $2. Yeah. It's like, I can go to Vegas and play a $5 blackjack table and I'm like in the zone, even though I'm not losing really. Like, I can play $20 on it for, you know, an hour if it's going well or something, and it's great. But that $5 is my admission price for sitting there and just entering into that like zone.
Yeah. And the issue is like, yeah, for $2, if you can afford $2, you get the fantasy, and maybe you kind of almost even also realize the fantasy. You go, oh yeah, we're just having fun. But I had a bit of a weird experience when I bought the ticket, which I didn't tell you about, because it's a very small thing, but I went to the liquor store around the corner to get it. And there was a woman there. There was, by the way, it was packed with people.
Oh, really?
Yeah, who were doing the lotto. So there's loads of people there.
That's interesting.
And there was a woman there, and she was doing that. She had her lotto ticket. I don't know how many tickets she bought, and she was buying one beer. So she had her ticket and one cheap beer. And there was something about it, because I realized that this woman, probably that was all she could afford.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't buy a few beers or anything. She was buying literally one
bottle
of beer.
Buying singular beers from a gas station is always such a curious, or liquor store, such a strange, strange thing. But what are you going to do with that one beer?
You know, but it felt like, oh my goodness, you know, she can't afford.
Yeah.
You know, she's playing the lotto. She's playing the lotto because she gets this fantasy maybe of, and I don't know who she is, so she could be very wealthy. She just literally wanted a beer. Mm-hmm. But the thought in my head was, if this woman can only afford one beer and she's maybe buying, you know, $5-$10 of lotto tickets, she's buying the fantasy, and the fantasy is an enjoyment for her, and she's getting 2 hours of, it was actually only an hour of enjoyment because it was 7 o'clock when she mm-hmm. was buying it. So she's getting an hour of kind of like enjoyment of the fantasy, but the fantasy is actually entrapping her in a system where she's actually paying money she can't afford.
Yeah.
And I'm going like, okay, and that's for, again, a symbol for lots of us, is that we are, our fantasies, we all have fantasies, that's fine, but sometimes our fantasies can entrap us into doing stuff concretely that damages our lives. Mm-hmm. And at that point, we need to traverse those fantasies. We need to see through them.
Yeah, I'm very good at living within fantasies that don't exist at all, and creating alternate timelines in my head and making assumptions and creating entire scenarios and attributes with people, especially in romantic relationships. We've talked about this before, but it's like the whole idea, and this is classic stuff. This is classic, Pete. The classic, like, I have an idea in my head. I remember, who was I talking to? Some for, I don't know. But it was like, you have your idea in your head of that grandiose romance. You have this idea of this swept away sort of like thing, because maybe at some point in your life you felt that at one point. And so you do you chase it, just like with Christmas, or just like with getting any kind of money out of nowhere, any kind of luck that happens to you, you kind of can chase it and enter into that fantasy. But I feel like so much of my adult life has been recognizing the difference between fantasies, because it's really easy to get caught up in them and not realize that you're even getting like caught up in it. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh no, this idea that I had about something has caused way more problems than it did. I think this is indicative, and I'm curious what you have to say this, because you may not like what I'm about to say.
Yeah.
This is gonna be controversial.
Not the first time.
Yeah. I think my fear, my biggest fear with a lot of psychoanalysis and a lot of this type of conversation, is because there is often, so often, like a double meaning behind things. Do you ever feel like you just overthink? I mean, and this is a symptom of mine too, and it might be separate from engaging with psychoanalysis, but my fear with the world of psychoanalysis in that lens is that it can cause, which you might not even view it as a lens. You probably don't view it as a lens, do you? Because it's not, lens is like, implies that you kind of can put it, take it on, put it off. But anyway, the fear is that it results in inaction. It results in sort of like, oh, this is this because of this, this is this because of that. And that can become its own fantasy, where you're like I feel like a lot of the Freudian stuff, the Lacanian stuff can be, I mean, it does have kind of a fantastical nature to it, because it's so, when you explain it to somebody, it's just like, hold on, wait, what? You think that like the moment we see ourselves in the mirror, it's the formation of the self, and that from that moment on creates a separation of you from nature, and then you spend the rest of your life trying to seek that oneness, ultimately seeking death, but fearing pain, and like all this. Yeah. And it's like, you start explaining, you're like, wait, it sounds very, very out there. Yeah. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, you know, when it comes to the actual practice, to quote Lacan, he talked about being against understanding, which is the idea that actually in analysis, yeah, it is very problematic to try to explain everything and try to rationalize everything, try to understand all the double meanings in your activity, and that actually that does lead to inaction and problems, and that the point is actually to reenact the relational dynamics. So in psychoanalysis, you will never or very rarely get a psychoanalyst who will explain things to you or give you very many interpretations or do anything like that. They mostly stay quiet and allow the person to project onto them their mm-hmm. brother, sister, mother, father. And then, so in other words, you know, what we do is, because we're talking as a podcast, we talk about the ideas and there's a whole kind of theory. But in practice, I totally agree with you that actually understanding is not generally very useful. If we're talking about this fantasy stuff, you can see through it all and still be entrapped by it. Or you can not understand any of the theory at all, but be completely freed from it. Heidegger Heidegger, who was one of the toughest philosophers mm-hmm. around, but said the people who understood his work best were the German farmers that he spent a lot of time in the Black Forest in the bar with these people who worked the land.
Yeah, because he had to deliver the ring to Mordor.
Yes.
That sounds like an insane, like...
The Black Forest.
Yes. Yeah. He spent a lot of time in the Black Forest with the elves and the...
the pixies.
The wicker people.
Yeah. But, you know, he felt that they were the ones who understood his philosophy best, not the university professors.
Yeah, the working
because
class.
They lived it.
The real people.
Yeah, the real people who lived it.
What a great answer. That's a great answer, because it separates psychoanalysis from every other thing that we fall into in this millennial internet age of, like... Take the quiz. What are you? What are you? What sort? Where did the sorting hat put you? Anyway, we've talked about that before. I got a fun deviation from you, real fast. I'm gonna throw this in. How much time are we doing? We're doing pretty good. Okay, this is. I want to know your thoughts on this.
Right.
We're doing at the Valley Folk. We did this video where it was movie titles that get mashed together. Mm-hmm. So it would be like, you know. Creature from Swampy Thing goes on quest to find hidden treasure in Oregon or something. And it's like the creature from the Black Lagoonies. So it's like you combine two movie names with the summaries. Fun game, really silly. In it, Steve Zaragoza presents a thought experiment. And I'm writing an essay on the thought experiment that we're going to put on our Valley Folk Patreon. And it's like 5 pages so far on why. First, I thought he was wrong, and then I came around to him. But I think the reason he's right is he's right for the wrong reasons. He doesn't know why he's right, and so, which sounds so condescending. Yeah. But I have this long thing, and I'm like trying to incorporate like evolutionary psychology and psychoanalysis and all this stuff. Here's the thought experiment.
Right.
Basically, he picks up a mug. It's this like mug that's got in the shape of like a jovial beer drinker, and it's this sort of like. Really old, colorful, happy guy, big old rotund, smiling face, looks kind of Italian. And he goes, what's more terrifying? This thing floating in front of you in the middle of the night. You wake up and this is floating in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
Or a doctor standing over your bed who says you have cancer. What is scarier? And I, out of the gate, was like, the doctor telling you you have cancer is scarier. And I was
and
like,
you're wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. I was wrong. And he goes, no way, man. He's like, no way. He goes, this, he goes, floating. He goes, it's proof of the paranormal. He goes, it's proof that something is out there. It's proof that there's life after death. And it's so weird and creepy. Mm-hmm. And so then that led me to being like, okay, what is this situation? Cause in my mind, I was like, you awaken and you see a figure and it's a menacing figure. And on some psychological level, evolutionarily, you will fight or flight, you will see a foreboding figure, and you will react according to that, and you'll be shaken from your stupor into action. Which means you won't be super terrified, because what's terrifying is the idea of stagnation, the idea of being paralyzed into fear. What would paralyze you into fear is seeing a mug that, this is me giving my opinion, what would paralyze you is to see a mug floating, because you wouldn't know if it's a menace or if it's friendly, and so you would be confused. And what is scarier than being confused? And so it goes into all this like stuff on like why we watch horror movies and what's actually scary and what's not scary, and like what's truly scary is that which like keeps us from doing anything and just sort of like shakes us and like jars us a little
bit.
Yeah, no, totally.
I mean, the thing is, and of course subjectively, you know, one may be scarier than the other for different people, but the reason why I think it's a great thought experiment, well done, Steve, why that technically is scarier, I think it's the same, like horror movies aren't doctors telling people they've got cancer, right? Mm-hmm. Horror movies are, you enter into a fragmented space where weird stuff happens that you can't quite figure out. It's because there is something scarier than a world that makes sense, but that is bad, and that is pure contingency. So I would say it's not even the mug as proves the paranormal or whatever. I think that's
an
explanation of trying to make sense of it.
It's a rationale
So for me, like if you take the floating mug as a symbol of an encounter with the pure chaos of being and existence, that's terrifying. So in philosophy, there's an idea that it's people will hold on to meaning even if it's to their detriment than give it up. So for example, someone who is religious and who has cancer might say, well, oh, this is God's testing me, you know, or this is God's judgment or whatever. But they would prefer to keep the meaningful universe that they have and negatively see themselves in it than potentially go, there is no reason for this whatsoever. Mm-hmm. This is a pure random
experience. Is this man dressed as a doctor standing in my bedroom in the middle of the night, not saying, hi, how are you? I have bad news for you. Straight up a man going, you have cancer? That's terrifying.
Well, that's terrifying because, again, that is, to be honest, more because it's cut from the context of going to a doctor.
Exactly.
So that is also an experience of the pure contingency of existence.
Mm-hmm. But I think because we are familiar with the human figure, we would react so quickly to that we wouldn't be... We'd be in action. And I think if you're in action, you're not feeling that level of like terror because you're not frozen. So you're busy, adrenaline's pumping or whatever. And the other thing that I brought up was the jovial nature of, I'm so sorry for how boring this might be to people. I think it's super interesting.
By the way, you could do that. If you win the lottery, you could actually set this experiment up easily with like 100 people and have like 50 people who in the middle of the night, we have a guy dressed up. And
you know why
others.
That wouldn't work? Because people would say that they were scared over one or the other, but they wouldn't understand. They wouldn't truly know what they were more scared of.
No, but you set them up with electrodes so you could measure their heart rate.
Wow.
And then you do 50 people with the floating mug and 50 people with the doctor. But both of them are very, you know, crazy experiences.
Yeah, they're very crazy experiences. You're definitely going to tell somebody about it the next day. The other thing I was going to say is the jovial face, the sort of smiling ceramic like beer drinker is, there's something reminiscent to like a scary clown. And then the scary clown, I was like, and it's all me bullshit. Like the joke of me writing this essay is that it's such a silly thing, really trying to dig into it. And it's really fun. But the scary clown thing, I was like, this represents the perversion of innocence. Which,
how did
harkens-
the doctor become a scary clown? I didn't realize he was scary. I thought it was just a doctor telling you he had
just
cancer.
A doctor. The innocent ceramic mug is a actual beer drinker, and he's smiling, but he's floating in front of you. And I was like, there's something about the innocent smiling archetype that is presented in, and you could say the same thing for the doctor, but there's something about this innocent smiling archetype that's directly in front of you, and you're like, it's unnerving to see like a clown or something. It's like the same way that you see a clown that's this jovial innocent thing, but some people are so scared of clowns, it's because there's some kind of menace attached to them that you have, that you ascribe to them. And it's the same thing, I think, with the smiling jovial beer drinker. And then that goes into the fear that we experience as like this sort of like when we lose our innocence, when we become sort of like who we are. And then that is like a traumatic event. And so the smiling ceramic thing reminds us of that and terrifies us more.
Okay. Because I heard you say it was just a mug that was floating, but is it a smiling
mug? It's a smiling mug the mug is a smiling beer drinking man, but in the shape of that. So it's like a doll, like a doll. It's like so it's like smiling at you and it's like all happy, but it's floating in your bedroom in the dead of night. That's terrifying.
It's terrifying. Yes. Well, I think this is a That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And for me, then abstracting it is to the idea of something as terrifying, just like cancer, but it's terrifying, but it makes sense, mm-hmm. to something that is terrifying, that fragments your sense of reality.
Yeah.
If it's like that, you're going like, the fragmentation of reality is, that's why you can have a horror film where nobody dies, mm-hmm. where it's just ghosts. I mean, why be scared of ghosts? Because they don't, generally can't do anything. Mm-hmm. They move your table around. I'd be quite happy to live in a house full of ghosts. You know?
I also
except
think that, yeah.
it's something eerie about it, you know?
I think there's something too to going to a horror movie and being like, it's like, yeah, see, this is what we're all scared of, right? And yeah. it's like, we're not really. I'm not. I
well, that's why, you see, action movies, hundreds, sometimes thousands of people die, and it's not terrifying at all because it kind of makes sense. Mm-hmm. But a horror film, nobody could die or one person could die, but it's about creating an environment where reality fragments. Mm-hmm. So it's very funny where you can just weirdly watch 100 people get shot, and it's not terrifying at all.
One of the few good things I'll say about the Zack Snyder Batman films is it does, I think they did explore that, where like the first Superman or whatever the first Zack Snyder Superman was, like they destroyed Metropolis or destroyed those cities. Maybe I'm even thinking of the Marvel Universe. They may have done it a little bit in Avengers, but like the next movie is sort of based on Superman being seen as bad because he just, in his quest to save everybody, demolished everything.
My friend Jay Baker, you know, he guessed that. I remember he's very into those movies, and when he came out of that first movie, he said, oh, he says, that'll be the reason why Batman mm-hmm. and Superman fight, because Superman, like, absolutely devastated a city.
Yeah.
And he was right, although maybe it's in a comic book, I don't know.
So it might be. I'm sure it is. Anyway, sorry for that tangent.
Which is a great tangent. And then one thought I had on the Christmas thing on fantasy, which might be worth throwing in, is it's not just that we can get caught up in our own fantasy and then do things that are damaging to us. Like, you know, the fantasy of Christmas, for example, where we buy loads of presents that we can't afford for the fantasy. Mm-hmm. But also, even more fundamentally, we get caught up in the fantasy of the other person's fantasy. So what happens is at Christmas, you fantasize that the other person is going to have such an incredible time. And so you spend all your money buying, say, presents for your kid, because you're kind of caught up in the fantasy that they have a fantasy that it's going to be wonderful. And what happens is two people start living off the fantasy of the other. So my niece, I think I've used this example before, my niece said to me once, I don't believe in Santa, and whispered it to me. And I said, well, why are you whispering? She said, oh, I don't want my mom and dad to know. And you could tell that she didn't.
Super cute. Yeah, is that true? That's so cute.
But it's very common. It's like she got to that age where she, you know, she didn't really believe, but she knew how much pleasure it gave her parents.
Yeah.
So, if, funnily enough, she's pretending she believes to give the parents pleasure, and the parents are pretending to believe to give the child pleasure. And so weirdly, they are living through the fantasy of the mm-hmm. other's fantasy. And that keeps Christmas kind of alive. And whenever the parents find out their kid doesn't believe anymore, it robs the parents of something, even though they see through the fantasy.
Yeah.
Because they're caught up in the fantasy of the child.
One of the reasons I do want children is so I can re-experience that stuff again. Because I'm like, I can't be totally done. And I know, I can't imagine how sad that is when your kid is just like, I know. Really, you found out? Oh shit. Like, because it's such a phantasmical thing that like so that children just across the world are like actually believe. I think it's so cool. And then I was discussing this with some friends the other night, where it's like, you're lying. They're like, you're lying to your kid when you say that. And then it was kind of about, I kind of like with a maybe a detached kind of whatever, was just like, you shouldn't lie to your kids. It's like, not even a little bit. Like, do you not lie to your kids? And I don't know what the ethics are in lying to children. I guess it's not good, but I feel like I'll lie to my kid and tell him that they're Santa nonstop.
And it's less traumatic. Seemingly, it seems to be less traumatic for the child than the parents when they find out. Because for the child, there's kind of enjoyment of, you know, I've learned this, I've discovered it. Maybe my younger brother or sister doesn't know. But for the parent, it can just be, oh, right, that's Christmas. You know, mm-hmm. the fantasy has dissipated.
Yeah.
It also happens in hospital. I talked to a pediatric nurse. Is pediatrics? So that's kids. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She was telling me that you'll often have a child who, whenever the parents come in, the parents will pretend everything's fine if everything's not. The parents will, you know, create a fantasy that everything's great. And the child, they know it's not great. The child will also create a fantasy, everything's fine, and the child knows it's not great. But the parents pretend everything's fine for the child, and the child pretends everything's fine for the parents. And so nobody believes it's fine, but everyone pretends because you're trying to sustain the fantasy of the other. Mm-hmm. And that is not a bad thing, but there sometimes it becomes a bad thing, and eventually one person has to say, listen, this isn't great, and we need to realize that.
Yeah, I feel like it's the opposite in Los Angeles. It's like going to the doctor and everybody's like just like so worried about their kid and helicopter parenting and all that stuff.
But oh yeah,
what
yeah.
do I know? I'm not in that world. Let me ask you this, Pete.
Yeah.
Let's say 5 or 6 sentences on, go back in time, you're at this party last night. Mm-hmm. You have the ticket in hand.
Yeah.
I've PayPal'd you $2. You don't know that. So one of those sets of numbers is mine. But then right before the drawing happens, I was like, we should split it if either one of these numbers wins, which is just my way of wanting half of your money. Mm-hmm. And because it was all on the same ticket, because I was like, grab me one. And so anyway, walk me through as best you can. Uh-huh. You know yourself very well. Mm-hmm. As well as anybody can, you're a philosopher, you're familiar with psychoanalysis, you have a good grasp on sort of the tension of life. Those numbers come through. One of them is you did it. You got it. It's mm-hmm. Your numbers come up. You're at this party. There's a crackling of silence. It's like, I didn't win. Oh, you know, maybe even you say that. Oh yeah, I didn't win. Your blood is just like you're thinning. You're about to pass out. Like you're a part of the people who've won $1.6 billion. Or maybe it's just you. Who knows? In your mind, you're like, I may have just won $1.6 billion. What do you actually do? Like, what do you think?
I didn't actually look at I mean, I could have won it. I don't think I did. But yeah.
You didn't. I looked at it. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah, because I took a picture of it for you. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, yeah, I double checked. Yeah. I was actually refreshing the page. I was like online, but you told me beforehand. But anyway, what do you do? What do you think you're realistically? Like, do you text me? Do you go, dude?
That would be one of the most fun bits of it, actually, would be, how do I tell Elliot that this, you know, this is going to be,
where are we going?
I wouldn't text you. I would drive over. Uh-huh. And I would go, listen, we need to, you know, let's go. Well, although you would know, if you didn't know, if I hadn't sent you a picture of the ticket, I would, I'd come back and
let's say I didn't know.
And I just go, listen, let's go for a drink and sit you down. And then, I would tell you over a drink. And that would be crazy.
I mean, that would be utterly life changing, even for me.
I think one of the few ways to not make it devastate your life. And there's a guy in Belfast did this, who was a bus driver who won the lottery, is he started some businesses. And I'm like, cause you have to have the struggle in life. So I think, like, you know, once you kind of win and you have all that money, you have to figure out a way. I would love to, for example, get, you know, we talked about this, mm-hmm. give money to my friends, but to invest in kind of some of their business passions. But you'd have to find some way of, you know, getting the money to work. Otherwise, I think it could potentially ruin you.
I know. I would definitely buy the drink if you had just won $1 billion. Yeah. I feel like that'd be a nice gesture.
Yeah. I wonder if you would know. Maybe I would bring you to like the fanciest place in LA and buy 2 bottles of champagne. So I wouldn't even tell you. I would just go like, I just order like the most expensive drink in the place and then let you guess what happened.
Yeah, that'd be fun. That'd be fun.
In fact, what would be even better is if I'd done that, but hadn't won. But I just was like, I'm going to $200. It's worth it for a laugh. I go like, Elliot, we need to talk. I bring you to the fanciest place and I buy a bottle of champagne and you're just going, oh. And I'm like, no, just buying a drink.
I would believe you.
You wouldn't believe me. I know. That would be too.
No, I think I would.
Oh, you would?
Because I don't think you would. I think you like the idea of that joke, but I wouldn't. I'd be sitting there going, I know he thinks it would be funny to do this if it wasn't true, but do I think Pete would actually go through the trouble of buying this? No, I don't think he thinks it's that funny to lie, and therefore I would start to believe you. And then when you were like,
and that's why I would be doing it, because I would have gone through this in my head. I would have gone, But then Elliot will think that I wouldn't actually go through with this.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
means I should go through yep, with yep, it. Yep, so yep, it'd be very, fun. It'd be meta level humor.
Yep.
Which would never happen.
Yep. It wouldn't happen. It's more fun to imagine that you, wow, that's a fascinating screensaver you got on there.
Oh, yeah.
Very,
it emulates like a 1980s computer.
Yeah. Super cool. Anyway, yeah, that's a very good, yeah. So I think about that too. It's those moments. That's the moment that I'm most curious about. The life that you would have after $1.6 billion or $500 million or $20 million is like, that takes a backseat in my mind to the fantasy of the 48 hours after winning the ticket. Yeah. Of like getting to tell people, getting to be like, hey, things get to be okay now. Like we, all of our surface level problems have gone away, at least, you know, in terms of financial stuff. Yeah. That part's that, really cool. Yeah.
But see, this is a thing where this is the other part of the lottery fantasy that I think is a total fantasy. Like, I don't think I would want to win. Like, I genuinely, and like, I'm financially stable at the moment, mm-hmm. so actually I don't need money. So I honestly go, I think having that money would just, I don't believe that it would actually make either of our lives better. I really don't. I think for you to invest some of the money in value focused stuff makes sense. But again, you know, $1 million would, I think, be almost more valuable.
It would be, to you. The pressure would be on at that point to, it would be an added stress and pressure. For one, there'd be a fear because I don't have trust issues. And so those aren't going to go away the moment I have money attached to my name. It's like, then I'm immediately going to have kind of a wariness. And I don't like that. It's nice to go through life having an openness toward people as best you can. And so that would be one negative. And then the other negative would be if you have like a so much money to do whatever you want with, and say you're in sort of you're artistically minded in some way, I feel like you would, like, you'd if you didn't make the best stuff ever after that point, you would feel horrible. Like,
but this is also a very LA fantasy, because I think mm-hmm. I grew up in Ireland, in Northern Ireland. It's like in Northern Ireland, generally people don't think anything about money. Like in Northern Ireland, in Belfast is a great place if you don't have money, because it's pretty cheap to live. But it's a terrible place if you do, because if you drove a Ferrari, you'd just be a laughingstock.
Yeah, there's a limit.
Nothing you could do with the money. You could buy, you could definitely buy a nice car and you could buy a nice house. But as I say, if you bought a Lamborghini, right, and you drove a Lamborghini through Belfast, it would be the most hilarious thing ever.
Yeah.
You'd be the laughing stock of the city. Whereas in LA, you could buy a Ferrari or a Lamborghini and it would be like, oh, that's pretty cool.
There's not even a slight part of me that wants one of those cars.
I know that I don't like Lamborghinis at all. I don't know, but whatever.
But yeah, I know what you're saying. Yeah.
So the thing is, like, genuinely, I think growing up, and it was, you know, there's lots of negatives about Northern Ireland. Like, for example, if you have get up and go, like, you want to kind of, like, you know, make a success of Valley Folk, mm-hmm. you'd find that hard in Northern Ireland because people are less inclined to try to, you know, really achieve something. Mm-hmm. Or if you are trying to do that, it's not the most conducive environment.
Yeah.
But on the positive side, like, it just, money is almost irrelevant.
I would use it. I would definitely get a lot of schooling. I would do. Oh, yeah. I would go back to school. I'd start studying all sorts of stuff, I think. That'd be really cool.
But then that's what I'm thinking. Like $1 million would be really valuable, say, to you. Mm-hmm. Because $1 million would get, you know, you could really invest in your art and your work and create some good stuff. You could do some schooling. It's like, what's enough money that actually kind of like, oh, it allows you to concretely enrich your life? And then that's a kind of amount that I think is useful. And it's not a lot. In LA, it's more than middle America, but it's not a lot.
Yeah, it is interesting to hear like what people would do with the money. And then you start adding that up and you're like, yeah, so you don't need that amount of money. Yeah. Like you're like, oh, so that comes out. There's a game online right now that's like getting passed around and it's this sort of very basic program game that somebody made. I think it popped up on Reddit. But it's spend all of Jeff Bezos' money. Uh-huh. And it's like, it's like, here's his $150 billion. What are you going to do with it? It's like, you wake up, you're him. No, you can't convince anybody you're not him. What do you do with this money? You go to the bathroom, you spend it, you start living your life. And it's like constant, you know, A-B testing throughout. And it's just like, you still have this much money. You still have this much money. You can, oh, you solved world hunger. Okay, you still have this much money. And it just goes and goes and goes. And basically the point is he's got more money than he could spend. And also he could solve so many of the world problems supposedly if he did everything like
that. Although I don't believe that, because I think The system is actually creates those problems. Anyway, as beside the point, I don't think money.
That's not a fun.
It's hard
to throw that conversation out. Yeah,
that's not going to come into this question. But that might be worth talking about sometime.
It is worth talking about, but it's definitely one of those things that's like. You're not going to sound likable when no, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't solve world hunger. Yeah. It wouldn't. The problems go deeper than just...
Yes. Not if world hunger, if the issue is to do with distribution and various issues, then.
It's
intertwined. It's enmeshed.
And it's a very simply minded idea to be like, $160 billion. Well, if you took $60 billion of that and just did this, it's like, no, that just did this is like
And the thing I'm asking is whether that the $60 billion that you made has actually caused more of the problems than it would solve.
Well, Amazon, so and I don't think they're a pretty altruistic company.
Yes. I mean, there's people who work with Amazon who are on food stamps. You know, that's what I've heard anyway.
I
need to back that up with data, but that's something I've heard.
But on that, like, that's a subject with the lotto that we haven't touched on, is that sort of like charitable giving thing and sort of like how, and you know what you would do, because that's sort of the obligatory thing that I feel like we immediately skipped over, but I assume it's only because it's so ubiquitous when you're talking about lotto winnings. Yeah. It's like, yes, you would give some to charity, but...
But the question is, I mean, this is why I hate this conversation. Because I think the lotto is one of the fantasies that sustains our corrupt system, i.e. it's kind of like this, you know, you get this ticket, this golden ticket, that fixes everything, that can cure cancer, that can end world hunger or get rid of homelessness or you solve crime. And it's like, but it's almost like the fantasy that allows us to continue to, you know, exist in a system that kind of like creates these problems. Mm-hmm. So the idea, and we live in a system where it's like, it's the ultimate, it's Judge Dredd. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing about Judge Dredd, very American superhero, is that he is the ultimate abstractor. So he comes up to someone who's committed a crime and he kills them. He doesn't take into consideration where they grew up, what their education is, how much money they have, are they starving, do they have kids to look after. Mm-hmm. He abstracts the person from their concrete environment and he pronounces judgment. And it's the same thing as when we start to think of, if I had this money, I would just solve world hunger. It's like world hunger is this abstracted thing. It's not enmeshed in the entire system.
World hunger is not a debt and a bank account that you just pay off and all of a sudden people are fed.
Exactly. And so it's like when we abstract from, say, homelessness is not the problem, it's the solution to a problem in our society. So, but when we take it as the problem and I go like, I'm going to just throw 100 million at this homelessness problem, but you're not realizing that the homelessness only exists because of certain structural problems in society, then the money, even if the money fixes homelessness in one place, that crack, that problem will arise somewhere else. So that's the issue, is like the fantasy of this thing of like giving all this money to charity, it basically solidifies the fantasy that these social problems are like a cancer that you can cut out of the social body, rather than these are a symptom that show a problem, a deeper problem within the social body.
I guess the only...
That's boring. Okay.
I like it. The only thing I would say in response... I did kind of completely check. I was like, my response.
Boring.
I think the only response I would say is the fantasy of solving those things is just as the fantasy of the lotto can be an enjoyable thing. The fantasy of feeling like you are solving world hunger, you're helping your community, you're doing all these things, or you're a good person, that has value in it too. But if you get stuck, if you were to use the logic from before and be like, oh, you could get caught up in that fantasy, it's really easy to get caught up in that fantasy if you don't have the money and be like, oh, if you have all that money, why aren't you just solving everything? And it's like, no, well, you might be caught up in this fantasy that it actually will, whereas that person is not caught up in that, you know, Jeff Bezos maybe, but I don't know anything about that guy.
Because you can have societies that actually have very little money, but, you know, like, I'm not talking about poverty, but societies that don't have a lot of money, mm-hmm. and that actually have an incredible quality of life, minimal homelessness, virtually no, prison population, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And it's not because they have loads of money. It's actually because those problems, the society is healthy.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, so that's like a lot of our fantasies, like when we have a fantasy about some man or woman we want to be with, again, it's decontextualized. the person that we're fantasizing is some ideal, but in reality, there is no person who is just this James Bond fit character or this, you know, this, mm-hmm. this kind of Lara Croft character. It's a fantasy that allows us to cover over the difficulties of life, but the best dreams are dreams that cause us to try to change our lives, not try to. So basically, if Nietzsche has a great term for it, the narcotics, he calls it the narcotic religions, I think, is it basically where he says, if you've got a toothache and you take a drug that gets rid of the pain, you're not dealing with the root cause, you're dealing with the pain. And he says, like, the things like the lottery are a narcotic, a societal narcotic. They kind of might cover over the pain, but it doesn't get to the root of why you have the toothache in the first place.
Yeah.
And so we've got a lot of narcotic dimensions to our society. But the big challenge is, okay, when we get over the fantasy, what do we really have to do to make our lives better?
Mm, on a structural, deep, very, very painful level.
And so for that woman who bought the one beer and maybe the three lotto tickets, I'm like, okay, the fantasy is taking away from maybe the suffering of her life. But at some point, it would be great for some friends to do an intervention and help her save the money, maybe $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000, maybe $1,000 a year she's spending on it, and go take that money and, you know, kind of use that in a way that will actually enrich your life.
Like what would be my question? Something that,
Okay, well, here's a good example. Say this fictional woman, because I don't know anything about her. She could be a billionaire.
But there are people like her out there, so let's say,
So that she's playing the lotto. It creates a fantasy that allows her to imagine getting out of her life. So an intervention is where you get the person to stop playing the lottery. Not so much to save the money, but so that she's confronted with the parts of her life that she's not happy with.
Yeah, it's less the money. It's less the money. Yeah, it's more the stillness.
Yes. So then she looks at her life and goes, actually, I'm playing this because I'm not happy in my relationship or my job. And then she's more likely to maybe go, so I'm going to have to leave this relationship or try and find another job. So that's the key, is the fantasy can often cover over the suffering, but the result is you stay within a situation that's bad.
Mm-hmm. It's the floating mug.
It's the floating mug.
And if you see the floating mug and you're like, you don't know what to make of it. So then it forces you to confront the confusion.
I think you're trying to shoehorn that in.
No, me? No, not at the end of the podcast. To try to make it seem like a more well-rounded episode. My takeaway is, congratulations to whoever won that money. Apparently, that you're saying there's a few winners, maybe?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure. Something came up on my news feed, but it might have been about previous years.
Oh, I see. Yeah, oh, yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. So, well, congrats if anybody won.
Or commiserations, maybe.
I don't know what that is. What's commiserations?
Like the opposite of congratulations. Hey, like, as
so
in,
sorry.
It may ruin
so
their
sorry.
Life.
Yeah. For anybody who didn't win. That was my joke last night. I was like, somebody said something. I was like, you know, I just took a pretty big financial hit about an hour ago, so I don't really want to talk about this right now. I lost out on $1 billion. So, this has been a fun episode, Pete. I have no real summary other than what I just said.
Yeah, I'll do a one takeaway with fear and trembling. So I'm going to quote Karl Marx. And I know Karl Marx is a divisive figure.
Good. But it's also very on brand. So.
It's very on brand, yeah. But he, you know, everybody knows that he said, you know, religion is the opiate of the people, right? So everyone knows he says that. But within context, it's really interesting what he's saying. He says, basically, religion is the opiate of the people. He says, it is the heart of a heartless nation, the soul of a soulless condition. He says, and he goes on to say, it is the imaginary flowers on the chains of our oppression. And he says, we must get rid of the imaginary flowers, not so that we see the chains in despair, but so that we can break the chains and pick living flowers. So whatever you think about Marx, whatever, just this quote is interesting in its context, because what he's saying is, to take the example of an alcoholic maybe has a life that's bad, and they drink, and that's an opiate, that's a type of narcotic that helps them escape their suffering. And Marx says, absolutely, of course you're going to do that. But he says, when someone does an intervention, they stop you drinking, which is the imaginary flowers, so that you can see your life. And that's always jarring. It's a type of destitution. But
like
you don't
floating mug.
What's that?
Like a floating mug.
But you don't do that because you hate the person. You don't go like, you're going to stop drinking to look at your life because I don't like you. You do it because you know that's the first step for them to actually break the chains that they're in so that they can pick living flowers, which is to actually maybe have a richer life. So sometimes our fantasies are the imaginary flowers on the chains of our oppression. And if they are, we need to somehow traverse the fantasy so that we can look at the difficult parts of our lives, not so that we despair, but so that we can make changes that will help us pick living flowers.
Well, and to add to Marx, and I know that that's, you know, it's also a decision of the flowers on the chains, if I'm following the metaphor, are beautiful and
yes,
and ornate. And the real living ones that you pick aren't good, or they're not as pretty.
They're not as pretty, yeah. They're like, oh yeah, who was it? I think it was Anna Freud who said, you can make the perfect omelet in your mind, but you can't eat it.
Yeah.
In other words, any omelet you make will not be as good as the imaginary omelet, with one difference. You can actually eat a real omelet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you have to go for the crappy flowers. Cool. Awesome. Thanks, Pete. That was fantastic. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Anything else you want to add?
Nope, that's great. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.